From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and I'm pretty stoked about tonight's lineup. Novelist Jonathan Lethem returns to our studio to talk about The Fortress of Solitude, his big, Brooklyn-centric, music-filled novel from 2003. Only this time, he'll talk about watching his book get made into a musical on stage this week here in New York. Also, our live music comes from the band called James. They're out of Manchester, England, and in the 90s, they had a big hit with this fun, gender-bending love song called Lays.
Dress me up in women's clothes, messing around with gender roles, dye my eyes and call me pretty.
James is back with a new album, a rockin' collection of songs about sex, death, and dancing. They'll play live for us. Hooray! Hooray! So, five guys in the band James. Jonathan Lethem is a guy, I'm a guy. You may be wondering, where are all the women? Well, to answer that question, you're going to have to look up. Way up to the top of the pop charts.
Because you know I'm all about that bass, no trouble. I'm all about that bass, no trouble. I'm all about that bass, no trouble. I'm all about that bass.
For the first time in Billboard chart history, female solo artists have occupied the top five spots on the Hot 100 chart for 7 weeks in a row. Joining me now by phone from L.A. is music writer Melinda Newman, who recently wrote about this record-breaking trend for Billboard magazine. Hi, Melinda.
Hi, John. How are you?
Well, actually, when you wrote about this trend, it was 6 weeks in a row. Now it's seven. And so how rare an event is this?
It's very rare. The last time that there were this many women in the top five for more than 1 week was in 1999, and that string only lasted 4 weeks. So this is the first time ever in the 56-year history of the chart that you've had solo women dominating the chart for so long.
Wow.
They set the record at 5 weeks, and now they just keep going.
And they keep going with the same song in the number one spot, right?
Yes. Meghan Trainor's All About That Bass.
Which is, a song not without some controversy, right?
In a kind of backwards way,
yeah.
In that people are taking it that she is slagging women who are skinny, when all it is really standing up for women of all body size and kind of saying, these pictures are photoshopped. Give yourself a little bit of a break if you've got a little bit of something going on in the trunk.
On the other hand, she does use the phrase skinny bitches, which doesn't sound too friendly to women who don't have as much going on in the trunk, as you say.
Except for, that has now just kind of become a phrase in America.
Yeah.
Whether it was Joy Behar used to say it on The View, or whether it was, some Real Housewives who would say it.
Mm-hmm.
And now it just kind of is a saying that people just kind of toss off, whether right or wrong. So I don't really think that she meant that in a harmful way.
So whether she meant it or not, she is sitting on top of this kind of murderer's row of female solo artists, and she hasn't even released an album yet.
No, I know. It's gonna be very interesting. As we all know, when someone comes out of the box with this huge a hit, it can be a blessing and a curse.
Yeah.
And that this just instantly becomes what they're always known for, whether it's James Blunt with, Beautiful.
Right.
Or it's really hard for someone when they have this big an impression to kind of keep the momentum going.
All right. She actually has a second single called Dear Future Husband, which has nowhere near the visibility of All About That Bass, which is still the number one song in the land. At number two, Taylor Swift with Shake It Off. At number three, we have Jessie J, Ariana Grande, and Nicki Minaj doing Bang Bang. Number four, Iggy Azalea featuring Rita Ora doing Black Widow. And at number five, the Swedish singer Tove Lo with Habits, which everyone is referring to by its subtitle, Stay High. Do you see anything in common in these five songs?
Well, Tove Lo kind of ruined it for all of our theories, which was that when Nicki Minaj's Anaconda was number five, was in the top five, all of these songs were fairly female empowering, and none of them were traditional love songs in that I'm nothing without my man. You know,
right,
you look
right.
at, you know, Shake It Off, All About That Bass, you know, very much kind of like, you know, I am an independent woman, and I am just, take me as I am. And, you know, if you've got criticism, cross the street. I don't want to hear it. 'Cause the players gonna play, 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 and the haters gonna hate, 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 baby. I'm just gonna shake, 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 shake. With Bang Bang and Black Widow, they were very much, hey, you come near me, you get what you get. I'm gonna love you until you hate me, and now I'm gonna show you what's really crazy. You should have known better than to mess with me harder. I'm gonna love you, I'm gonna love you, I'm gonna love you, I'm gonna love you like a Black Widow, baby. It's Twisted Cat and Mouse. And Tove Lo kind of ruins it with Stay High, because that is about a woman who is just trying to find anything she can do to keep her mind off her man. But there is something about, these are all women who are kind of claiming their lives. They're not necessarily, other than the case we just mentioned, seeing themselves through the prism of a man.
Right. But the Tove Lo song is actually a pretty interesting song.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, every time she sings the word high, her voice actually drops. I eat my dinner in my bathtub, then I go to sex clubs, watching freaky people getting it on. It doesn't make me nervous, if anything, I'm restless. Yeah, I've been around and I've seen it all. I get home, I got the munchies, binge on all my Twinkies, throw up in the tub, then I go to sleep. And I drink up all my money, tasting kind. Pop from Scandinavia. That's happened in the pop charts before here in this country. Tove Lo with her song Habits. That's at number five. The last of a string of five women who are dominating the Hot 100 chart for 7 weeks, with Meghan Trainor, as we mentioned before, leading the way. Melinda Newman's on the line with us, freelance music and pop culture writer for outlets like Billboard and Rolling Stone. And you can find a link to Melinda's piece about this trend for Billboard magazine on our website at soundcheck.org. Is it a trend? Is it just a moment? What do you think? What's the bigger picture here?
That's what no one can decipher, because only in hindsight, will we be able to look back and see, you know, what's going on. When I did my piece, there's certain people that thought this was actually a movement, that it kind of parallels, you know, women being powerful in the country, and that women are really, really kind of just standing up and taking their claim. Someone, I actually didn't put it in the story, but even took the through line all the way to Hillary Clinton potentially running for president, and that there's just this whole, you know, powerful surge of women right now. Other people feel that this is cyclical, that it's wonderful this is happening, that we have these new voices out there. You know, Taylor Swift's the only one that we would have even known about a few years ago.
Right.
So we have these new powerful women out there, but that it is just a cyclical phenomenon that happens. You know, 2 years from now, the chart will look completely different. We're in a very rhythmic pop stage right now at Top 40 Radio, and that tends to favor females. Most of the male pop that happens this way is either urban leaning, which we did not include in this phenomenon, which is, you know, an amazing phenomenon as well, but we didn't include for this story, or the pop rhythmic males are kind of on hiatus with Justin Timberlake and Bruno Mars between albums.
Mm-hmm. And with all of this, this wealth of female talent, if you look at the number three song, Bang Bang, you've got three of these girls working together, Jessie J, Ariana Grande, and Nicki Minaj. Now, Nicki's been around for a few years, but the other two are relative newcomers, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think that's another reason that everyone is looking at this is, wow, are we seeing the next wave of women whose names we're going to be hearing, you know, for the next 5 to 10 years? And you look, we've had a lot of really strong female artists in the last several years, you know, whether it's Lorde, whether it's Miley Cyrus, obviously Katy Perry continuing to rise, Adele.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, and of course, I mean, the godmother Beyonce, the mothership for female empowerment artists. So it really is a great time for female artists, whether they're at the top five or not.
And people are saying that this song, this Jessie J, Ariana Grande, Nicki Minaj collaboration, it's like the Lady Marmalade of 2014. The song is called Bang Bang. So that's Bang Bang from Jessie J, Ariana Grande, and Nicki Minaj, sitting at number three on the Billboard Hot 100. Five women occupying the top five slots for 7 weeks in a row. That is a record. The old record was 4 weeks, so it's a record by almost twice the old margin. Melinda Newman wrote about this for Billboard. You can read her article on our website, soundcheck.org. Now, what strikes me about this, Melinda, is you've got all these women doing gangbusters on the singles chart, you know, with a Hot 100. Those are singles. You look at the album chart, and it's a dude fest. You know, it's like this week, it's country music, 1, 2, 3.
Again, that's cyclical, but there are two things to say about that. First off, the top three selling albums of the year are all female-driven, which are the Frozen soundtrack, which, mm-hmm, of course, has Idina Menzel's Let It Go, and then Beyonce and then Lorde are the top three selling albums of the year, and then probably the only act at all that has a chance of selling more than 1 million copies this year is Taylor Swift with 1989, which comes out next week. So women are in there for the long haul, and the numbers are great. But the other thing that you're seeing is a lot of these songs in the top five, their single sales are soaring, and people are going in for the song more than for the album at this point. And then, of course, like with Meghan Trainor, as we said, there's not a full-length album out yet.
Right.
So that's also cyclical. Country males are having a very strong time right now. Like, we'll probably see Florida Georgia Line come in at number one next week. So that will continue, you know, country males on top. But the women are definitely ruling the pop radio.
And in terms of Taylor Swift, you know, they're predicting what, like 800,000 sales in the first week for that record?
Yes, and her last two albums both sold more than 1 million their first week. So it just kind of shows her popularity certainly has not waned. That's just another indication of that people are not buying albums like they were.
Right. Well, they're certainly buying singles, and they're buying lots of singles by women like Meghan Trainor and Iggy Azalea and, yes, Taylor Swift. We've been speaking with Melinda Newman, freelance music and pop culture writer for Billboard and Rolling Stone, Variety, and more. Melinda, nice to talk to you again.
Thank you so much, John. Take care.
Welcome to New York.
Up next, we'll talk with author Jonathan Lethem about the new musical adaptation of his best-selling 2003 novel, The Fortress of Solitude. And later, live music from the band James, who scored massive 90s hits with songs like Sit Down, Sound, and Laid. We'll hear some of James's latest album right here in the studio, coming up on Soundcheck.
Tell me you're up.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. When Jonathan Lethem's novel The Fortress of Solitude came out in 2003, he made a kind of mixtape to go with it, a collection of songs that inspired this story, this coming-of-age saga, set in Brooklyn in the 1970s, and this tune by David Ruffin was Jonathan's lead-off track. Well, now The Fortress of Solitude has acquired another soundtrack, because it's being produced as a musical at the Public Theater here in New York. Its previews are over, the show is now officially open, and it runs through November 2nd, and Jonathan Lethem is back with us on Soundcheck. Hey, Jonathan.
Hi, nice to be back.
I don't remember whether we talked about this on the air or off the air, but when The Fortress of Solitude first came out, you were kind of talking about, I had asked you whether it could be adapted into a film or something, and you were kind of leery of the whole film thing.
Well, I mean, I'm always ready to be persuaded. And there have been film options and attempts made to adapt this book. And I even participated in one screenplay myself. But I always have thought that it presents really unusual obstacles or pitfalls. I mean, there's a lot of colorful outward action, events, set pieces, and so forth. But there's also a lot in that book that depends on things that only prose fiction can do, kind of the passage of time and interior monologues and tricky point of view perspective changes. And so I just thought I didn't know. I didn't know if it really stood that chance.
So when they said, well, what about a musical? What did you think about that?
Well, it's the very definition of a left field moment for me. I don't identify with musicals the way I do with narrative film. You know, there are a lot of storytelling forms I respond to kind of natively. I grew up with comic books, movies, novels, and in fact, what I know of musicals sort of in my DNA comes from watching, you know, West Side Story or The Wizard of Oz on TV year with my family. So I know them as a film, you know, subset of my film interest, and a couple of them I'm very responsive to. But I'd probably seen, I don't know, 7 or 8 stage musicals in my life before this question came to me, before Daniel Locken, the director, proposed it. And I was so disconcerted, but I also really liked Daniel, and I was at a kind of a high watermark of my skepticism about the film options. And it took me a while to gain confidence that it was a good idea, but I knew right away it was a diverting one.
Well, you know, one of the funny things is, as we've heard from you before, you are a huge music fan.
Yeah.
You're a music obsessive.
Right.
And you had very specific ideas about the music, about what Fortress of Solitude sounded like in your mind's ear.
Yeah.
Was it hard to cede that to Michael Friedman, the composer and lyricist?
You know, I mean, of course, it didn't sound like theater music, like the you know, cast soundtrack recording of Pippin or something. That's not what it sounded like in my head. But the best case that Daniel could make, and it was a very persuasive one, was that this book was saturated with sound,
right,
and that was why it was calling to him. And so I thought, well, you know, let's find out more about what he has in mind and let's see what's possible. And the next thing he did was bring Michael Friedman in.
Right.
And at that time, he was much less, you know, he was not a meteor in the sky the way he is now.
Was before Bloody Bloody Andrew.
Before Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, and he was doing songs with the civilians. Now, I think a lot of people knew he was brilliant, but I certainly didn't know his name. But Michael instantly started talking about the kind of midpoint he wanted to reach between pop music style and the theater music. And that's when I started to kind of really climb aboard and be excited about the whole thing.
We're speaking with Jonathan Lethem about the musical version of his novel Fortress of Solitude, which is running at the Public Theater through November 2nd, with book by Itamar Moses and composer, lyricist Michael Friedman providing the music. He did Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson and did a terrific job on Shakespeare's Love's Labor Lost.
I didn't have a chance to see that.
Yeah, well, let's hear a little bit of what he did. This is from Fortress of Solitude. The song's called If I Could Fly.
If I could fly like Superman through the sky, I'd live forever in my fortress of solitude. A fortress built for Mingus Rude. I'd rent my tag all across the city, and you could be my sidekick. I'm just walking down the street, and the street is lonely. There's no one to save me. There's no one for me to save.
That's from the Dallas cast recording of Fortress of Solitude.
Terrific. That's Kyle, who's also singing that part.
Here in New York?
Very major part here in New York, yeah.
So right away, in the first couple of lines of that snippet, we get the idea of the Superman, you know, of the superheroes, the
yeah.
idea that superpowers might be something to even consider. You also get tagging, you know, graffiti. So you get one of the big arcs of the story, and you also get one of those tiny telling details all within, like, the first 10 seconds of that bit of music.
Yeah, the amount of compression and the way the songs seemingly just sweep up all the kind of thematic stuff of the book in these small gestures is really, it's an incredible thing because, you know, a novel is a big pile of stuff. There's so many incidents and so many sentences and so many, you know, pieces of figurative language, and it's very hard to adapt them to any other shape or form. They're mostly just too big and too
right.
and too various.
Well, and this is what, like a 500-600 page novel.
It's a longer book. Yeah.
It tells the story of Dylan Ebdus, who's a white kid, and his friend Mingus Rude, who's a black kid living in Brooklyn in the 1970s. And it's a time of creative upheaval, but also financial upheaval. The city is broke, etc. So it's a big story, but it's also a very intimate one. It's a story of two friends.
Yeah, I mean it. I wanted the backdrop of the book when I was writing it to be almost like a giant glimpses of a giant documentary about New York City in the 70s. But in the foreground is always not even, you know, all of Brooklyn or even all of, you know, Gowanus, but just really one block,
right.
one block of Dean Street between Bond and Evans. I thought if I could just capture that, I'd satisfy myself.
Yeah. And I mean, the evocation of a summer evening on Dean Street in Brooklyn, circa 1975, is, you know, I don't even need to go back to that page and reread
well,
that.
Thank you.
But how does that story, that kind of big/small story, change for the music theater?
Well, one of the things that I, you know, took me a long time to be able to articulate, this is going to sound like a very complete thought, but it was 10 years arriving as they worked on this project, is that theater, and musical theater especially, creates a kind of metaphorical dynamic space where it is figurative language because you're calling on the audience to use a kind of reader's type of suspension of disbelief to animate the events into reality. They're not real, and they're never pretending the way a film with special effects might be pretending to be real. Instead, they're all gestures in a kind of language because stage music is a language. And so this is a very beautiful match, not only to the idea of adapting a book in general, but this book in particular, which contains within it this constant issue of pretending to something that might be impossible. Mm-hmm. The white kid pretending to be black, the teenagers pretending to be superheroes, the musicians inventing themselves in these slightly larger than life personas. Mm-hmm. There's a constant, and even the fitful, you know, attempt of this street to be a place, to be a community. There's this kind of reach. You know, that clip you played of Kyle Beltran singing, it's not pop music, but it leans in that direction, and his singing has some gospel pop roots in it. And again, it's like one thing trying to become another. It's something with a secret identity, and you're not sure which is real.
Well, now, in Fortress of Solitude, both in your novel and in this production at the Public Theater, you know, it's not just Dylan and Mingus, the two kids. Mingus's dad is Barrett Rood Jr., who is a former lead singer with a group called the Subtle Distinctions. Now, of course, there was no such group, but you have left an opening there for a composer to create a whole body of work.
Yeah, opening is a nice word for it. I sort of demanded that Michael write something that could be credible as a radio song, or a couple of them, in, you know, late 60s, early 70s, soul in that register specifically, and I think he did some amazing work.
This is from the musical theater production of Fortress of Solitude, running at the Public Theater through November 2nd.
Red, red is the color. Every time I wake up and I'm holding you, every time that you make me feel the way you do. But green, green is for envy. Every time that I see you with another guy, every time that I catch you in another lie.
They released three albums in 3 years. The deceptively simple sounds of the Subtle Distinctions, 1970. In Your Neighborhood, 1971, socially conscious and therefore unpopular. And then, in 1972, Nobody and His Brother, featuring the hit single Bothered Blue. That's track two on the CD I gave you.
Black, black is the color of a man walking nowhere on a lonely night of my sunshine.
That's a little bit of the stage production of Fortress of Solitude, based on Jonathan Lethem's novel, running now at the Public Theater. Jonathan Lethem with me on soundcheck today. And there's a kind of a neat moment there where the character of Dylan says, on the CD that I gave you. This is the stage production getting really kind of meta, because you did exactly that when the novel came out.
Well, yeah, in that sequence, and it matches to part of the novel, he's written a liner note about this, what to him is a great lost soul singer who needs to be rediscovered. And he's sort of championing this music without being completely emotionally honest about what his connection is to it. And so, yes, it's very much the crate digger's kind of attitude, like, you got to listen to this.
Is that why you did this kind of two CD mixtape that you distributed to friends after the novel came out?
Yeah. I mean, when I made that, I was looking to celebrate what felt like a kind of a really threshold book for me, and it was being published very beautifully by my publisher, Doubleday, and I wanted something to say thank you to a lot of people with, but also it was a way of not letting go. Making the mixtape after the book was in galleys was a way for me to live in that space a little bit longer. And I worked quite hard, not just on arranging the two track listings, but with my brother, we made this kind of graphic accompaniment for the liner note. And it was actually a sort of a nice physical object that had a lot of photographs and little extras. It was kind of a bunch of extras for people who were already responsive to the novel, or people who'd helped me with the novel, people from the neighborhood who knew where it was from.
And were these songs, were you actively listening to these songs while you were writing?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, those and many others. I'm always listening to music while I write.
Yeah.
And by the time I finish a book, especially a long project like this one, I usually have distilled in a way the songs that are for me kind of an emotional keynote to it. And sometimes the connections are quite literal, and you know, so that CD was full, for example, of the kind of lost great soul singer that I was trying to evoke in creating this fictional singer. So people like Howard Tate or James Carr.
Syl Johnson.
Syl Johnson, O.V. Wright. But then again, there are other songs that are much more, you know, intuitive and not obvious why they relate to the book. But for me, in some way, they
well, let me ask you about one
sure,
of those
yeah.
because it is a playlist full of classic R&B and soul. And then there's Brian Eno's Golden Hours.
Yeah. Well, in fact, that is quite a literal connection to the book because the book, that song is cited on the last page. It's playing as the one of the boys and his father are driving through the snow, and it becomes pregnant with a kind of sad, strange feeling that I think pervades the end of that book. It's a kind of non-ending ending in some ways,
right.
Very pensive, and. The song relates to a time in my life when listening to that seemed to suggest a kind of other world, a mystery that was unsolvable but that I wanted to abide with or dwell inside. So it's very personal.
Several times I've seen the evening slide away, watching the signs taking over from the fading day. I've seen the evening slide away, watching the signs taking over from the fading day.
Golden Hours by Brian Eno, certainly an outlier in the playlist that Jonathan Lethem created for his novel Fortress of Solitude. Perhaps more down the middle of the road for this is Syl Johnson with a song like Is It Because I'm Black?
Yeah.
Which, you know, race is one of the big themes.
Absolutely.
In the book.
And I think, you know, Is It Because I'm Black? Was a great, I mean, it was as much a talismanic song for the writing of this book as there could be. Because there's something about this guy who basically his career was doing, brilliantly sung, but second-rate soul songs. And a lot of them were very kind of either mawkish love songs or fake James Brown, like, you know, Miss Hot Pants and stuff.
Yeah.
And then suddenly he just barrels out this crazy, you know, kind of manifesto about why am I stuck in life? Why am I not getting where I want to get? And it goes on. It's way too long for the radio, and it's just...
Oh, yeah, it's like a seven-minute song.
It's a seven-minute song.
Yeah.
And it's so on the nose. And one of the things I knew writing The Fortress of Solitude was that I had to go at the heart of the matter and be unembarrassed. And this song, you know, Is It Because I'm Black? It's sort of like, wait, don't say that. And this book is very much about saying the unsayable thing right out and then working with everyone's embarrassment that you've said it. So, you know, me in a way saying, yeah, I grew up as the white kid in a black neighborhood. It was really uncomfortable. And just laying stuff out there, you know. So
in your version of a seven-minute song, a 600-page novel.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, there's just simply the emotional power of the number.
Let's hear a little bit of Syl Johnson's Is It Because I'm Black?
That splash against my hollow bones, that rocks my soul. Oh, 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 oh. Looking back over my false dreams that I once knew, wondering why my dreams never came true. Is it because I'm black? Somebody tell me, what can I do? Oh, Lord. Oh, something is holding me back. Is it because I'm black? Yeah. In this world of no pity, I was raised in the ghetto.
That is Syl Johnson. Is It Because I'm Black is one of the songs that Jonathan Lethem put together on this kind of mixtape. It ran to two CDs that he was distributing to friends and family after the publication of his novel, The Fortress of Solitude, in 2003. Fortress of Solitude is now running at the Public Theater through November 2nd. It is a musical these days, and Jonathan Lethem's with us on Soundcheck. He doesn't always sound like he does today. So you've flown in from California.
Yeah, for the opening. And I, on top of a slight traveler's cold, yeah. I was at the opening and kind of shouting too much at the party, hugging the cast and crew and, you know, celebrating. Actually, I brought some friends from the old neighborhood. So it was a very intense gathering.
You are so identified with New York in general and Brooklyn in particular that it's just so hard to think of you living out there in California.
Well, you know, I've done it a few different times. I lived there all through my 20s. I guess I've sunk so much of my creative stock in this kind of claim to a deep Brooklyn identity. The irony for me is that, of course, that consists in itself of wanting to run away. Mm. And I've done it repeatedly. You know, I think the true New Yorker is actually ambivalent about the place, not simply entrenched there.
A big booster.
I'm often really happiest when I've put it in the rearview mirror for a while.
So Fortress of Solitude is a novel. It is now a musical. Let's go back to where we started. Could it be a film?
Well, you know, I say this, and it's not a pretense. I sort of think now the movie should be of the musical. I just would rather have it. I'm so enamored of this translation they've done. It seems so complete in a way that I really can't see a film managing to be.
Well, I should mention Michael Friedman, who's been on Soundcheck and who did Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson and Love's Labor's Lost and has done the music and lyrics for this public theater run of Fortress of Solitude. And you, Jonathan Lethem, always moving on to the next thing, and your most recent book is in the 33 and a Third series on the Talking Heads album, Fear of Music. So give me your elevator pitch on why this album is a masterpiece.
First of all, Talking Heads people always want to say to me, why not Remain in Light? And I love them, you know, as a listener, I love them equally. Remain in Light is unstoppable. But for me,
that's their fourth record.
That's their fourth record.
This is the third.
This is their third. It's the middle of the three they made with Brian Eno as producer. There's something about the tensions that underlie this record that really excite me. It's a band trying to stay operative within their old format. You know, four players on a stage, bass guitar,
keyboard, and drums,
and also trying to operate within, you know, kind of the standard vernacular of the you know, two to four minute song, and yet they're exploding with this desire to transform themselves into something else. Those pressures, but still being applied to the traditional format, somehow result in something that I find explosive.
It's a very dark-hued record, even down to the album cover, the black corrugated paper of the album cover. Robert Fripp did the guitar solo on E Zimbra, and for you as a man who works with words and who lives with words, what was it like to hear that opening track that is all nonsense words?
Well, it's funny. I resisted E Zimbra when I was young, and that record came out. I always wanted to hold it kind of apart. I thought it disturbed me in the way it pushed against the logic of the rest of the record, which has there's kind of a storyteller's arc in the songs and a conceptual clarity to the songs, and then that one song seems to be a preview of the Stop Making Sense idea, which is that they're going to, well, in many ways, take Eno's advice and explode language and use it just as a percussive or a kind of a abstract element.
Well, the song E Zimbra is the opening track from Talking Heads Fear of Music, which is the subject of Jonathan Lethem's most recent book in the 33 and a Third series, a whole book about this third album by the band Talking Heads. And again, Fortress of Solitude, the musical, is running at the Public Theater through November 2nd. And Jonathan, great to see you again. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, John.
Thank you. Up next, it's the band James, whose hits like Laid and Sit Down made them one of the biggest bands in the UK back in the 90s. But their latest album, La Petite Mort, is nothing to sneeze at. It's some of their best work to date. We'll hear them playing live right here in the Soundcheck studio next. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The band James formed in Manchester in 1982 and quickly became associated with the whole Madchester scene of danceable, emotionally direct, alternative rock. They went on to become one of the biggest bands in the UK in the early 90s, with a string of hits like Sit Down, Sound, and Born of Frustration. In 1993, they caught the attention of Brian Eno, who produced Laid, their best-known song here in the States, and one of the best songs ever about sex. After a hiatus in the early 2000s, James reunited in 2007 and released another four albums. Their latest is called La Petite Mort, and it was released this past June. James joins us to perform a mix of music old and new here in the Soundcheck studio. And as the title La Petite Mort indicates, death is a theme in a lot of these songs, including the one that they'll begin with. Here, with Moving On, is James.
Please don't get me started looking backwards to move on. Open-hearted, except leaving when leaving's come. Gone, didn't see it coming, never said I loved you, hope you knew. Now my bags are packed and my sails are tacked and my course is marked by stars. When this cycle ends, will it start again? Will we recognize old friends? I'm on
start again. Will we recognize?
Moving On is the name of the song from the latest album by the British band James. The album's called La Petite Mort, and it's out now. The members of the band who've joined us here in the Soundcheck studio, Tim Booth on vocals. Tim, welcome.
Hello.
Jim Glennie on bass. Jim, good to see you too.
Hello there.
Mark Hunter's at our piano, and the guitar is played by Larry Gott and Saul Davis. And the album La Petite Mort, The Little Death, literally, you know, which is, I mean, it's a term from the world of sex as well as as describing death. And death is a part of it. It's, death as a figure stomps through this record in his
big,
dark boots.
Go on,
jump
in there.
Yeah.
Go on. When we were writing this record, basically my mum died. And then one of my closest, most beloved friends died a few months later. And so they were the lyrics that came out. But my mum's death, she was 90. She was ready to go. I flew back from Los Angeles. I got to spend a day and a half with her, cuddling her, holding her, singing to her. And she passed in my arms. And it was a beautiful experience, which nobody really talks about that. And so the songs, which that song you just heard, is mainly about her, but it's also about my friend Gabrielle passing. But it's an uplifting song.
Right.
And as a band, also, whenever I kind of do introspective, dark lyrics, that often, as Jim will tell you...
Yeah, I mean, you know, you don't kind of want emotionally a record, obviously, with a dark lyric, you know, with kind of morose music behind it. I mean, that'd just be kind of come a bit too much and a bit depressing, really. So we tend to kind of counterbalance that. And the record, even though hopefully death is a kind of big feature on it, it's a very uplifting album.
Well, that is the thing that is most striking about this La Petite Mort, is this kind of tension between what you hear in the lyrics. And, I mean, we heard a little of Curse Curse to come into the segment today. It's like as danceable a piece of music as you guys have ever recorded.
Yes.
So, you know, big themes, death, sex, football. Lionel Messi is the great Barcelona player is mentioned in the lyrics to Curse Curse. And through it all, this kind of, I don't know, this...
it's a celebration of life. That's why we used a sleeve. We took an image from The Day of the Dead and made it more psychedelic. Because in those cultures, they celebrate life. In England, it's like death is swept under the carpet. You don't see it. You know, it's really... It's something that will never happen to you until you get to about 50 and then suddenly it's like everywhere. And it's kind of... So we don't have that approach, you know.
Yeah.
And my mother's death felt like a birth. And nobody had told me that was possible. We made this incredible video.
I was just going to ask you about it. It's on our website, Soundcheck listeners. You can see it on the webpage at soundcheck.org. Were you involved in the kind of the thematic, the making of that video?
Yes. We know this beautiful animator called Ainsley Henderson, won awards, beautiful.
BAFTA winner, yeah.
He put in a script, first of all, that was pretty rubbish. And then we kind of rang him up and told him what the song was about. And I talked about my mum's death. And he took this thing, oh, my mum's death felt like a birth. And then within 2 days, he'd handed in this script that none of us could finish because we were all crying.
Yeah.
And it's up for Best Video of the Year awards and many different categories. And it's
the
amazing.
Best kind of visual kind of thing we've ever been involved in. I mean, it's just beautiful and it's difficult not to cry when you watch it.
It is almost unbearably poignant and it is all yellow yarn.
Well, what happened was, you know, he's walking around trying to think of a script. And he's got the headphones on, he's listening, and he passed a wool shop with all these yarn balls in the wool in the window. And he heard the line, time always unwinding. And he went, that's it.
Mm.
Such a great metaphor, but a yarn of wool unwinding. Mm.
So, you know, over the years, I mean, here in this country, the song Laid was the best known song that James has done. And it's a pretty frank and open song about sex. So La Petite Mort is sort of continuing that. The phrase actually appears in one of the songs on the record on Frozen Britain.
Yes.
And, you know, in the song Curse Curse, the opening line is, you know, hotel room, next door someone's getting laid.
Yes.
When you wrote that, was that kind of, did you think everybody's going to go back to 1993 when I sing this?
We had this playful song, Curse Curse, and it was we were really excited by it. And I got some of the lyric quite early on, and I knew it had to be a tongue-in-cheek, witty lyric. And that one was actually one of the hardest songs to write, because writing a funny song is hard without it becoming boring after four listens.
Or a novelty act.
Novelty act. So it's got to be kind of witty that lasts. So that one took a while. Whereas all the songs really around birth and death came effortlessly because there was so much emotion behind them. But yeah, we purposely had that reference to Laid in there, and you know, and the idea of men watching football and how ecstatic, close to sexual congress men get when a goal is scored.
There is a kind of epic song on the album that you're going to do for us called "Walk Like You." Now, Tim, you've been doing this a long time, and it always amazes me when a singer can go up there and get those high notes after, you know, decades in the business.
Now you've set me up. Watch me miss them.
But clearly you're able to go and do that.
On a good night.
So what's your secret? Zinc tablets? Do you gargle with...
Yeah, I don't know. I've always been able to get into the falsetto range. I mean, I'm losing some of it a bit. And you made me very nervous now setting this song up like that.
Tim Booth and Jim Glennie and the rest of James. Once again on guitars, we have Larry Gott and Saul Davis. Mark Hunter on keyboards. The latest album by James is called La Petite Mort. It came out in this country in June. And they're going to perform the song "Walk Like You" live on Soundcheck.
You know more than you think you know. This universe is in your inside the galaxies collide. Which parent told you that you're slow? My absent dad, my mom's control, schooled me to be a worker drone. So this is it, a life on Earth. We're made of stars, we're made of dirt. Unconsciousness, we disconnect, tone deaf to calling. We learn to walk like you, talk like you, ooby-doo, whine like you, fight like you, love like you in pieces. God knows I know no better. Easy to say. So this is it, a universe of birth and death, love and neglect, lest we forget, dad's off on tour or in a meeting. We will not walk like you, talk like you, ooby-doo, whine like you, fight like you, break like you in pieces. To blame for what we've become. Bored with your stories of pain,
shoot yourself with a ricochet.
That is the band James in a live performance of their song Walk Like You, which you will find on their most recent album, La Petite Mort. And if you'd like to hear more from the band James, including a song from that great old album, Laid, check out our website at soundcheck.org or our free podcasts on iTunes. Tomorrow on the show, singer-songwriter Moby stops by to talk about what he's been up to lately, a post-apocalyptic photography exhibit here in New York. We'll find out more. And live music from the band Adult Jazz. Yeah, the name made me skeptical too, but I think you'll really like their soaring art pop sound. That's tomorrow on the program. That does it for today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.